Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is August 29th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Beyond Potluck, the Kitchen Community / Hospitality, presented by Beatrice O'Jackengas, number OJB 2005-01. Let's listen in.
Bernard Antonio.
Okay. That sounds like a real
Okay, this is the Beyond Potluck session. My name is Beatrice O'Jackengas, better known as Peaches. And this whole series that we're going to do is, thank you. The first one I want to talk about, kitchen community.
What happened here? Searching. That must be the cable.
Setting up image. What happened? Today we want to talk about kitchen community and hospitality. I'll just go through this real quickly. Tomorrow I want to talk about feasts and celebrations, things that we can both celebrate at home and in our churches, because this has gotten to be a really important thing in our community. The third one, on Wednesday, we'll meet in a different place. We'll meet in the dining room. The topic will be Bread is Life. Let's make it. And so I have some a mixture of grains to make Ezekiel bread. And we'll do a little hands-on workshop there. We'll try and, how many of you have made bread before? Oh, we got experts. Okay, and then we'll start, on Wednesday, we'll also start the mixture. We'll cook the original mixture for making lefse, because that has to be made, the mixture has to be made the day before. And on Thursday, then, we will do hands-on rolling out of the lefse and getting the perfect one. How many have made lefse before? Only a couple, okay. And I do lefse lessons in Duluth always in November, because we make lefse for our Ludovic dinner in December. And then I've got a totally different topic for Friday, which will be back in here. World War II, how did we survive? And I think I'd like to see if you have any good stories about how people altered the way they cooked, and what happened during, there's some really kind of fun things that developed during World War II that changed the way we actually eat today. And we were short on a lot of things. You know, we had a lot of products that were rationed, and how do people get by? How do they deal with that? So, that's where we start. Now, let's see if that'll work. Yeah, just push that down button. Oops, you went too many too fast. Uh-oh.
Is there an up button?
Yeah. Okay, next one. Just hit real lightly. All right. The Bible is riddled with a lot of references to eating, to feasts, to being together. In fact, I think it almost ties everything. I'm looking at it from a very biased viewpoint, because to me, food and is so tied in with community and with hospitality. And it goes, I mean, you can pick out hundreds of references in the Bible to food and community. Interesting thing, though, is that there isn't a lot of this kind of stuff published recently. If we were just talking about this in the library or in the bookstore, that if you look up hospitality on the internet, you run into websites that tell you how to run a restaurant and how to run a hotel and that part of the hospitality, which is not what we're going to be talking about. We're talking about hospitality. I mean, we For instance, in Proverbs 15, the cheerful heart has a continual feast. Isn't that hospitality? There's a prevailing, there tends to be in our communities today a prevailing aversion to getting into the kitchen. And my feeling is that people really need to get into the kitchen, and when you're in there, you really get to know each other. And we'll see, we'll try to, you know, figure out how we can accomplish that, or some ideas anyway that can be accomplished. We want to extend that. The cheerful kitchen produces happy or cheerful food, and that really is part of the thesis that I have wanted to go ahead with. I guess I have to depend on my husband to turn this thing around. Live welcoming to all. There are lots of references to hospitality and being welcoming in spirituality kind of books. Henry Nouwen, I think, is a favorite of all of ours. He said, hospitality requires the creation of a friendly, empty space where we can reach out to our fellow human beings and invite them into a new relationship. And I believe that begins with the host. It also, the large part, begins in the kitchen. Just look at the way kitchens are built, homes are built today with huge kitchens. Where does everyone gather? In the kitchen. What about in our church anyway, First Lutheran, it's in the kitchen where a lot happens, whether it's planned to happen there or not. You know, the kitchen is a place where people get together. And that is where hospitality can begin. I'm going to talk a little bit more about what some of the negative things, but
who was a Matilda?
Oh, she is one of the Matilda of Magdeburg. I tried to find something here in our library, but she was one the same, a contemporary of Hildegard of Bingen, of all the mystics of the 1200s. And this was, I'd like to find, I read this reference in a book, a magazine called Weavings. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you get Weavings here, but it was on, the whole topic of Weavings that time was about being welcoming to other people. And welcoming to me equals hospitality. And if you live welcoming to all, that has a very broad meaning. I've heard that a lot here at Poland. Let's switch to the next one here. When you're being hospitable, am I blocking your view?
I'm fine.
I just was trying to think of the practical things that happen in a kitchen. Or in your church or in your home. What's a hospitable home? Well, you've got to smile, you've got to be open, you've got to listen to other people to make an extra effort to make people feel special. And serve the Lord with gladness. Psalm 100. Try and figure out. Okay, there are lots of references. We can switch to the next one. Make the food you prepare and serve an expression of your love and your faith in the future. Turn it to the next one. Eat only as much as you need. Now, how about that? I found that, and I thought that's kind of fun to mention because we have an insatiable hunger today, and it's one of my another whole topic that we could get into is the problem that we have today with obesity. Eat only as much as you need, but you know, people I think of my mother, you know, she said she'd eat something just looking for the flavor. And I think that's the way our food today, instead of with emptiness, empty flavor, and makes us eat too much. But only eat as much as you need was direction in Proverbs. Psalm 107, for he satisfies the thirsty and fills the hungry with good things. And that all goes along with the idea of eating, being satisfied with what you're eating. And there's two kinds of satisfaction to eating. One is the spiritual satisfaction that you get from something that actually tastes good and is good for you. Go on to the next one. And then food is a bridge. The Old Testament has a lot of references to foods and feasts and celebrations. The hospitality of food and eating together. And God does desire to feed and nourish people. And that comes throughout the whole Old Testament and the New. I think that the next slide is a reference to that. In Genesis, Old Testament food. Thought I should just read this. Be interesting to mention this. Now, if you have, I mean, I'm going to open this up to a discussion afterward, because I think that we have some sort of vague things going on here, and then there's some very practical things we have to apply it to. In the Old Testament food, trying to find all my notes here. In Genesis, God created everything, the birds, the seeds, and the weeds, and the fruit that had seeds in them, all the animals, and said it was good. And it was for our use. In Isaiah, he will feed his flock like a shepherd. I love Isaiah 55. It's probably very familiar to you. Ho, everyone who thirsts and comes to the waters, and you that have no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without price. Now, doesn't that speak of hospitality? And this is sort of a background to the way that we've looked at some feasts and celebrations at church. We don't put a price on anything. If people can pay, they pay. If they can't, they just, I'll talk more about that later, but if they can't, they can just go right through the line and get their food. We don't set prices on meals. And then everyone should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor, because it is the gift of God. And that's from Ecclesiastes. Then, I think the next one is New Testament food. The beautiful story of Jesus on the road to Emmaus. I don't know how to say that, because I've always read it, but I don't hear it very often. Lots of sermons have been preached on this topic. But the people traveling with him, of course, did not recognize who he was until they sat down to eat. And there again, the reference to sitting down to a meal. And in John 21, I love that one too, the fish breakfast that Jesus prepared. The first time he appeared after being crucified, what did he do? He fed people. He cooked breakfast for them. So those are some of the things that are sort of background biblical things that I think are really, really valuable. Now, food is love when used as God intended it to be used. Food and eating is relational, and it's a way to express affection. Now, if you apply this to church meals, we want to open the doors as much as possible to everybody, whether they're in the community of the church or outside the community of the church. And we keep trying to find ways to do that. We've found one thing that we've done in our church at First Lutheran is to have Lenten suppers, and I wanted to tell a little story about that because I think it's kind of fun. It used to be, and I think we can go, appreciation of food is our response to blessing. Click the next one, I think it might lead to what I was going to say. Share community meal. Oh, this was something I heard the other day, that the sign of a growing church is one that shares community meals at least twice a month. I thought that was rather interesting. Okay, click the next one. Okay, there are challenges to this too, and I referred to this earlier. And this is where the story of what happens in a church kitchen really begins. There, in the old days, do you remember, or have you experienced TERFs within churches? And you'd come in and you'd say, and it was Grace who was the one who guarded the kitchen. You know, you didn't go in there and touch anything without first having her approval. And you have to kind of break that turf guarding principle in a church kitchen. We managed to do that. Organ bench is another one that gets very guarded. And sometimes it just takes a well-placed depth before that can change. But usually, the kitchen, when they're guarding the turf, the person who wants to feel very important is very possessive. If automatically, if you're possessive of the kitchen and the surroundings, nobody's going to want to volunteer. And how do you recruit volunteers to help when you really can't get anyone interested in what, you know, they think that they're going to come in and really work hard. It's kind of a place where nobody wants to come. And you really have to be hospitable. I've got a lot of pictures, and I think it's probably on my next presentation, of people that are working in the kitchen together, and we have a great deal of fun with our Lenten suppers. We and even with our Ludifus dinner that we have in the fall, and when we have stewardship meals, and when we have global mission meals, and all of these are meals that are kind of, it's not like cooking quantity for a hospital. It's more than cooking at home. So it's an in-between niche that's very difficult to find information for. But we managed to get a bunch of people. We have more volunteers than what we're able to actually have work for. So when I started doing the Lenten suppers, for instance, we had maybe a half a dozen people volunteering. But then when we started doing some unusual foods, we started creating things that were with different flavors and coming up with salads and soups and stuff that were made from scratch, but with different flavors. People enjoyed that. I guess I should backtrack and say how this all happened. It was about 20 years ago when our Lenten suppers had gotten to the point where it was soup and sandwich. We opened cans and the creative cooking was mixing cans together to make a new kind of soup. and then people would make sandwiches and bring them to church and exchange them. Well, it all just sort of dwindled down to almost nothing. You know, there were about a half a dozen people, or about a dozen people at the very end. And finally, one of our pastors said, oh, we've got to do something about this. I was in this meeting and thought, well, you know, maybe if we started baking bread. We started making bread and started teaching people how to make bread. That might work. So we started, and we thought, well, we'll just bake bread, and then we'll put out sandwich makings and make soup from scratch. So we started doing that. We started making bread, And a couple people wanted to learn how to do it, and that was great. And now we've got just a whole slew of people who are, even kids this high, you know, would come in and want to make bread. And then we have, so we'd end up with a lot of volunteers, and people in the kitchen, you know, I thought, well, if we've got, you know, men, retired guys, young women, I've got 15 minutes, I've got a half an hour or so, they'd say, and what can I do to help? Well, if people are going to volunteer, you've got to have something for them to do. So what we started doing is making a lot of different kinds of salads, real simple things, and different kinds of soups. And so we had quite a variety of food that was not like the typical potluck. Am I making sense to you? Do you know this?
Yes.
No, I think, you know, this whole thing is sort of in between what, you know, like I said, in between home cooking and hospital cooking or institutional cooking. There is a whole area there that where our church kitchen cooking fits right in, because our church is our home, and we want to do things that are interesting there. Actually, people have learned a lot of things.
Well, so I have a question about the bread.
Yeah.
Now, most bread that I know of, you wouldn't be able to come in at 6 o'clock and have it already by 6:30. So how did you do that? Did you have people that could cook during the day?
Actually, what happened is we have people that come at 9 in the morning.
Okay.
And there were some kids that were being homeschooled. And they would come in, and they would want to learn how to make bread. But at first, we made just one kind of bread, wild rice bread, three-grain bread. But then we had to make more kinds because we needed more bread, and we thought, well, why not make different varieties of bread? Okay. So, and then there were some retired men that wanted to learn how to make bread, and that was great. So they'd come. We'd sort of schedule it so that a lot of people had time between 9 o'clock and 12 o'clock in the day. In the afternoons, they'd say, well, you know, I've got this appointment or that or the other thing. But we would get a lot of things done in the morning. But the bread does take time. And there would always be a couple of people who could stay long enough to shake the bread and bake it. Then another good time for people to volunteer would be later in the afternoon, between, say, 3 and 5. There are those people that, you know, would work until 3, and they'd say, well, I can come because I want to go to the Lenten supper, the service, and then come to the supper. And so they would come early enough to sit up, you know. And so it's that was how we organized that. Bread baking does take all day, you know, for the most part. But that was a very good question you brought up, because I didn't really know what people were going to want to hear about. But I would like to know how other people have handled some things and some ideas that other people have come up with in their own churches or in their homes. Now, what's the next slide here?
How many people come to Lenten suppers?
Well, we start...
I'm not familiar with that term, Lenten supper.
Oh, during the Lenten season, the 6 weeks before Easter, on Wednesday evenings, we have a church service that lasts exactly 45 minutes, and we use the Holy Communion prayer. And then right after that, we have a supper, and everything is done by 7, which makes it very convenient for families and for a lot of people, because then they know that at 7 o'clock they can go home and they've got the rest of the evening free. So usually it's a very well-planned service, but it is during Lent that this happens, and then the meal that comes afterward. But it turns out that meal time is the most wonderful community time within the congregation.
What time does your service start to do that?
It starts at 5:30. And the meal starts at 6:15. And everybody gets served. Now that we've ended up with like 300 to 350 people coming every Wednesday night.
Well, we kind of do it the opposite. We have our supper at 6 and the services at 7.
Yeah, we used to do that. And the reason we do this, and it may just be the community that we're living in, but people would be picking their, usually right around 5 to 7 o'clock, 5:30 to 7 o'clock is a time when there doesn't seem to be so many things scheduled. And people can pick up their kids from school or from piano lessons or whatever. And people coming in from work, we have a lot, everyone who works, you know, would be able to be there usually by 5:30. And so the service is, we try real hard to keep it exactly the right length of time. And then the meal has to be one that is appealing. And the kids love this. I mean, this meal is very appealing to them. We do have hot dogs. I finally broke down with the hot dog thing. but I'll have some pictures of food. I think it's probably tomorrow, but because I want to do the feasts and celebrations and Lenten meals kind of fall into that. But anyway, one thing that I'll switch on to the next one here. Strategies regarding volunteers. You really need to keep your expectations real. So nothing, you know, people who want to learn how to bake bread are going to have to learn from the very beginning, the very scratch thing, and you don't try to make them do it real fast. You have to have something for people to do. And in the process of volunteering and working in the kitchen, people gain ownership of the meal. And it's amazing how this spreads out among the congregation, among the community. People say, well, gee, come, you know, because I'm working on it. And maybe sometimes other people, you know, come to help in the kitchen. We have helpers that belong to other churches that come, which is kind of amazing. Next one. And then you want to plan menus to suit the occasion. And I've been mostly talking about our menu during Lent, but we do have other things that go on during the year. We just finished this just about a month ago. We did a special meal for choir or people. It was an elder hostel choir kind of thing, and we were asked to, you know, get volunteers together. And I have no trouble getting people to volunteer because they love to come in and put something together that really is fun to look at and fun to accomplish. So we do some decorating. We have to keep everything, we try real hard to keep things simple. You have to be welcoming, and this is for hospitality in general. You be welcoming, but don't expect anything in return. And that always, and then if you get something, it's a pure gift and a surprise. And one way, during any of these meals that we talk about every person as being a special guest. So when we serve our Ludifest meal in December and we get 1,400 people, I still like to look at them as individual people, each one a special guest. And when you look at it that way, it's a lot more fun. I'll switch to the next one. I think I know it'd be okay. These may not show up really well, but I've got just a series of centerpieces here. And the idea here, basically, is that if you're going to decorate, you can just kind of flip through them. If you're going to decorate or do anything special, use the stuff that you have on hand. We have some friends who are, they travel in Sweden a lot. And she's always buying little things in Sweden. Well, for this choir meal that I mentioned, I asked them if they would do the centerpieces. What kind of, and then they said, well, what kind of budget do we have? Well, there's no budget. So she just brought these things and just kind of cleverly put them together, and it made the most colorful centerpiece. Here's somebody cheerily helping in the kitchen, my friend Helen Giltzett. Some of you may know her. Let's see, switch to the next one. Here is part of our meal. You can see the decorated tables in the background. But all of this is done just with the simplest possible. I mean, you can do a lot with colored napkins and make a buffet meal look great. This was our smoked salmon and meatballs, and these people wanted a Scandinavian-style smorgasbord thing, so that's what we did. And here the people were coming through, and we were serving them a rhubarb punch. Now, there's another economic thing. It's economically easy to accomplish. Flip to the next one.
I was going to try to make it darker.
Well, I don't know that you're going to be able to make it look any.
Why is rhubarb punch economic?
Because rhubarb grows in everyone's backyard. One thing we did this summer, we had as a special celebration at our church, we had a rhubarb festival. And it was for the benefit of the Central Hillside, which is a there's a ministry to the people that live in the Central Hill. A lot of homeless people drop in at this drop-in center, and they're always in need of funds. And we held this rhubarb festival. And boy, did we have a lot of fun planning that, because there were a lot of people who had rhubarb in their backyards and never use it. And so they came in with all this rhubarb, and we made rhubarb juice and using the finished juicer, and we had several churches involved there, but it happened at First Lutheran. And we raised like $6,000 for the Central Hillside Ministry. And it was something that just kind of caught the fancy of people in the community. So this we can't see it all, but there were servings of our punch. She's the lady who collected all these things for the centerpieces. And there was that's just the final picture of but the bread's in the basket here, and our meal, the face down meal. That's all the pictures I have for this session here. I know I've kind of done this in a rather loose way, and I would really like to have some discussion, feedback, ideas, whatever. Does this bring up ideas of things that you have done in your churches, or things that you have tried to accomplish as far as cooking for groups? Yes?
Well, we have a congregation of approximately 150 people. And so every Wednesday night from the second Wednesday in September till the middle of May or the first of June, we have suppers.
Wonderful.
And we cook for anywhere from 50 to 75 people.
Mm-hmm.
And there, for a long time, Nona and two of her good friends did it for many years, and then they kind of wore out a little bit, and so they started asking for somebody else to take over, so the three of us decided we would try. It was hard to fill those shoes, I'll tell you. But anyhow, Nona comes down about, on Wednesday mornings we quilt.
Mm-hmm.
And so as we're quilting for Lutheran World Relief, and Nona comes down and makes bread. And she kneads it all and gets it all in the pan and everything. Well, by the time quilting is done, then it's just about ready to punch down for the first time. And so then after that, we start cooking our soup for the evening. And by that time, we get our bread in the pan and raised and out of the oven about a half an hour before mealtime. Our suppers we do have a price on our suppers. All of our adults pay $3. All of the kids school age are free. When 5 years ago we had one child middle school age in our congregation. Now they're not all in our congregation, but we have 25, 35 kids come
that's
in
great.
Every Wednesday
that's
night.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's another great approach to meals, community meals. And it's great for, I really feel that
having meals like this in a church is just the place where it should be.
But then after, then that's at 6 o'clock, we have our meal, and we try to get everything cleaned up as fast as we can afterwards. 7 o'clock is service, and then sometimes there's choir practice after that. Before is band practice. We have a contemporary band going out. Mm-hmm. Pastor Lori is great on drama.
Where is your church?
Faith Lutheran, Albany.
Oregon. New York.
Oregon, yeah.
Oregon.
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay.
And Pastor Lori is great on drama, and she has a drama class, the skits. I mean, all of the services, almost all of them, have a little skit with them. It has brought the kids in.
Many of the kids that come, their parents do not come to church.
And a lot of those kids...
Most of them.
And a lot of those kids are from very, very not well-fed families.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them come because that's the only really good meal they get.
That's really, really great. So, and, you know, I think the fact that you're doing something that is needed in your community, I think more of us need to do that.
The parents are the old folks, the ones that are over school age, pay, and that's what sustains us.
Mm-hmm.
We're not here for profit, it's just for...
Yeah. That, well, we always said ours isn't for profit, but we... Rather than to put a price on anything, what we end up doing is we put a basket next to the end of the buffet table, and people can put in what they want.
Mm-hmm.
We have at least a dozen people, that, or more than that, that are mentally, that are handicapped,
mm-hmm.
that are disabled in that way, and they don't really have money,
mm-hmm.
but some people who can are much more generous, and those who can't, or sometimes they'll say, I didn't bring any money with me. Fine, next week is fine. You know,
nobody checks anyway.
Nobody checks anyway, and so we've never had a problem, and we've always come out at the end of 6 weeks with at least, and I mean, this last 6 weeks we ended up with $1,200 excess, which we gave to Bread for the Hungry. And we always announce that that's what if we have more money than we need, we're putting it into a Bread for the Hungry or the food shelf or something like that, rather than it doesn't go into our regular running church funds.
If we have anything extra, why, we'll have a special dinner.
Oh,
for the congregation,
sure.
At no charge. So
yeah.
That it works that way too.
It's very true, the camaraderie in a kitchen. You can't find it any place else, really.
When you're working elbow to elbow, and this is something I had wanted to mention earlier, I'm glad you mentioned this, we are in a world right now that is so divided.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people, families, communities, everyone's divided. There's so many issues that divide us. And when you start working together in the kitchen with other people, you find the things that are common. That we had, you start talking about things when you're in the kitchen, and we never have any arguments about, the things that are different between us. It's always, the things that are that tie us together that become part of the conversation. This last 6 weeks we were. And I wasn't really crazy about it. We read Rick Warren's book.
Purpose
Driven Life. And we all agreed we didn't like it. And we thought, that's just great. It's just fine, you know. You can agree that you don't like something. And we'd read this thing for the week, and we'd say, I don't know, I can't go along with that. You know, and you find out a lot about people when you realize that you have a lot of similarities too, a lot of things that you agree on. And so it doesn't mean that you have to always read a book that everyone's going to like.
One thing I want to add to the notice
yeah.
of bread making. If there's any little kids there during quilting, she invites them into the kitchen as she's making bread. Wash your hands. They get up and wash their hands, and she's there, and two kids on each side of her, one on each side of her, kneading bread. They get a punk about that big, but they get to knead it and bake it and get to take it home. And that's so, I've got pictures, it's just precious.
That's really the fun part. We've got these kids too that have learned, but I actually put them to work so that the food, the bread that they made is going to be served on the table because we...
Well, these are preschool.
Yeah, well, that's really fun. But there is some reality to the fact that what you're going to be making is something that you're going to serve others. And so if guys come in and they're creating carrots, they'll say, well, where is this going to go? Or I buy all these ingredients and get and parcel out little jobs to different people and say, well, this is how this is going to go together. And I'll tell them what the recipe is. And it's just great fun to hand it to them and say, well, let's just see how this works. I haven't really tested it yet. I mean, I don't test any of these things ahead of time, but as we go, we'll correct it, you know. What I do as far as getting recipes is I never go to the hospital food for 50 type of books because they're just too boring. But I do check on recipes from, well, Moosewood has a lot of good ones. And then a lot of the Silver Palette and then a lot of things are just plain practical. I mean, we did, you know, we have a great big green salad that's just fresh spinach, dump the fresh spinach leaves that you can buy, you know, and sliced mushrooms go into it. And then I just mixed equal parts of honey and vinegar and just drizzled that over at the last minute, and it's the best salad. You know, and it just goes over well. And you take some real simple, we never use bottled salad dressings or mixes of any kind, which reminds me of funeral lunch we went to this winter. I thought, boy, they could use some inspiration there. We the funeral lunch was potlucked, and it was 8 different colors of Jell-O, and scalloped potatoes that tasted definitely out of a box, mixed with a little bit of hamburger. And I thought, you know, this wouldn't draw too many people coming back.
Yeah. Especially if they're dead already.
Well, the ones who were eating it were not dead. when people come, one thing we've been doing a lot of is roasting vegetables. You know, and we started doing that because I thought, those wonderful vegetables that have started to show up in the grocery store. So we have roasted turnips and roasted broccoli and roasted cauliflower, and you know, they taste so much better when they're roasted. And so we have platters of these roasted vegetables. People love it, you know, that kind of augments salads. And people learn to do things, you know, if you're kind of into what's happening in the food field. Otherwise, we just apply it to our suppers and people learn it. And they take it home, they say, oh, I've been roasting vegetables ever since. You know, roasted potato salad is great. Roasted carrots are like candy. Yeah.
When you roast vegetables, do you baste them with anything?
What we did was, I just have people prepare these vegetables, and part of them would go into a raw vegetable thing. What we did was just put them in a great big bowl and toss them with a little bit of olive oil and a little bit of kosher salt. Spread them out on a pan and roast them in the oven. We have a convection oven. And depends on the vegetable, like carrots will take maybe 20 minutes, whereas the broccoli and cauliflower take a little bit less time. But that's all we do is just toss them with a little bit of olive oil. We go through a lot of olive oil and garlic too. And they laugh because our kitchen smells like garlic sometimes. That's not very Lutheran, but it's... And lots of rosemary. We use a lot of rosemary.
Do you need a convection oven to keep them from from burning?
Well, the convection oven is a convenient thing because you can do so many panfuls at the same time. And the convection oven will rotate the air in there, so that's why you can do many pans at once. You can do it on a regular oven, but...
Yeah, I do them in my home oven, so with shell or roasting pans, and then you just switch shelves about halfway through. It takes longer than the convection.
Yeah, it takes a little bit more, but we have a convection oven that we bought used at the church. So... what else was I forgetting to say? Any other questions or thoughts or ideas?
Well, I guess I was wondering how you would handle the possessiveness, because I have experienced that in a church.
We have a little bit of that right now, and I'm not the one that's possessive.
Because it's really difficult then. This particular person, I had been there earlier, that she had, and I'd worked in the kitchen, and then she came and had gotten a particular job, and... before you know it, the kitchen was hers, and it was always a little difficult to say.
You know, that is a psychological problem, and she probably needs a lot of attention, and I think I find that with the person that I deal with. And so you need to praise her a lot and ask her for all kinds of information and whatever she can give you, and kind of work with her. That's at least how I deal with this. Because you know that someone who's going to guard a turf has a reason for guarding the turf.
Do you ever have to sit down and just say, this is a problem?
I haven't had to with this person. But I'm sure it depends on, you know, others, you know, who it is. But it is one of those things where this kitchen belongs to everybody. Not just one person.
We have the opposite problem at our church.
Yeah?
The kitchen belongs to everybody, and everybody does things, and then they don't... They don't clean up? They don't clean up, or we need something done. It's hard, and the same five people always are the ones who are putting in the sweat.
We have that is a problem with cleanup. You have to, but if you specifically, and it helps when you've got a pastor who will be willing to work with you, especially in Lenten suppers, before we go down, we're not going down until we get five volunteers to clean up afterward.
Yeah.
Boy, those hands go up really fast.
And we have less problem when it's during an organized time.
Yeah.
But... you know,
Cleanup
people
is
come in and use the kitchen and then leave stuff during other times.
The other thing is that, first of all, there's an ownership thing too. You've got to be proud of your kitchen. You've got to keep it clean. But then once in a while, I think it's worth it to just plain hire someone to clean the kitchen. Yeah. One thing I was going to mention earlier in this thing. When I was talking, is that at one point we decided we would use caterers to do stewardship dinners, and fewer people came.
Mm-hmm. Use
and
what?
Stewardship dinners.
Caterers.
And, you know, of course, caterers have to clean up after themselves really nicely. However, what we discovered is that people didn't feel ownership with the meal. And when you're in there preparing the food, you feel like you have some ownership. And that, I think the ownership is the real key to getting participation, getting volunteers, getting people to come. I wish I could describe it better, except that it is just an ownership issue.
We have our, in our church, the Sunday before Lent, we have a pancake lunch after service.
It's a classic time.
That the teenagers, the high school students, put on. And actually a lot more people get involved in that I mean, not just because they're parents of the teenagers, everybody gets involved in that. We have pancake races and the whole thing, but that's probably our most, our best attended and
meal.
And nobody has a problem cleaning up after that one.
Well, and what the other thing is timing. Yeah. When did you do that, on a Sunday?
Yeah, we do that one Sunday after service.
Okay. We did, for the first time this year, we did the Mardi Gras Sunday.
Right.
So the theme for the menu was all yellow and green and purple.
Yes.
So all the food was yellow, green, and purple. And it's amazing how you can really come up with that.
And it's not Jell-O.
And it wasn't Jell-O. But green and purple grapes, and then we used napkins that were along the theme, and it kind of kicked off the it was a brunch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, orange carrots, grated carrots.
Oranges.
Yeah, oranges. Yeah, yeah. So that's a good thing. We're going to talk more about other kinds of feasts tomorrow, but this was sort of an introduction. Okay?
Well, just a sharing for churches in downtown Seattle. A lot of homeless people around and people that run out of money before the end of the month. So the church provides a no strings attached complete dinner on the last Sunday of the month, when people's money has run out, and then put posters around the neighborhood. And at first, I think people would be a little suspicious, you know, is there something, is this another? But over the months and years, you know, there's maybe 250 people that come to this. It's
each
all
time?
Free. Mm-hmm.
Every night, that's wonderful.
Well, it's just once a month.
Yeah.
But it's after church on Sunday, and it's encouraged that we who are members there also eat there with them, because otherwise it's we're serving them. Instead, we're eating with them.
So who pays for this meal?
The church does. The church also is a food bank.
Okay.
It has a food bank, and so sometimes it's food that has been donated. There's one woman in the congregation that figures out the menu each month and buys what is needed to buy, but some of it also can come from food that's been donated.
Okay.
Do you want to give a plug for the movie tonight?
Oh, yeah. Talk about hospitality. We are going to be showing Babette's Feast in here tonight. And Babette's Feast, how many of you know Babette's Feast? Even if you've seen it before, I've seen it about four or five times. Every time I end up seeing something new and different in it. And the thing that struck me this last time is that Babette's Feast is really such it's a slow movie, but it's a deep movie. And kids aren't going to think it's really exciting.
No chase scenes.
No. Chase scenes. But the thing that struck me so much about it, as I saw it again and heard and talked about it again, was just the scene, the setting, and it is set in old Denmark. You know, it's a very very strict, bold Lutheran sect. And people were, after the guy who kept it going died, they really splintered real badly. And people started, you know, spreading rumors about each other and carrying grudges and doing all sorts of things. And then, of course, Babette shows up on the scene. And Babette, and it's a whole story about how she gets there. But the thing that is really tremendously moving in the end is the fact that Babette ends up being for working for 12 years for these two sisters, and she, somebody had told her that she had won the lottery, this $10,000, and she asked if she had asked for anything before the whole time she had worked there, and asked the daughters if she could prepare the meal for the 100th anniversary of their father's birth. And of course they were all very skeptical, but they thought, gee, she hasn't asked for anything, we better do it. They will just keep their mouths shut and not say anything about the food because it's so earthly, you know. Mm-hmm. It's terrible to and she spends her whole 10,000 francs on that meal, which is just like, you know, pure grace. She spent everything she had, and it was such a, the way that it ends is just such a, you leave thinking, boy, there's hospitality, you know. So I hope you get to come to watch the movie tonight. We've got it on DVD, the show record.
So what time is it?
It's at 8:30, isn't it?
8:45.
8:45, okay. Well, I thank you, and if you have any other things that come up, we're going to be talking about feasts and special meals tomorrow, and I hope you'll come back and come with some ideas, some things that you have done. I love the thoughts that came from the group already today. Thank you.
Thank you.